Platonist philosopher and a leading member of the Platonic Academy of Florence, organized by the city's ruler, Lorenzo de' Medici, but the new emphasis on personal responsibility and the possibility of self-creation as a work of art was in no small part a consequence of the rediscovery of a series of crucial classical texts which served to reverse the trends of medieval learning. Renaissance humanism was predicated upon the victory of rhetoric over dialectic and of Plato over Aristotle, as the cramped format of scholastic philosophical method gave way to a Platonic discursiveness. So now we don't have, it's not merely propositions butting heads, conversation and the coming together of propositions like a good Socratic dialogue can actually go somewhere. We can gain ideas through the, it's no longer a mere conflict. Much of this transformation had been prepared by Italian scholarly initiative in the early 15th century. Lorenzo Valla, an anti-authoritarian humanist, used the recently discovered manuscript of Institutio Oratoria by Quintilian to create new forms of rhetoric and contextual criticism. But even more important was the rebirth of an enthusiasm for the philosophy of Plato in Medici Florence at the cultivated court of Urbino. Precisely to service this enthusiasm, Marsilio Ficino, head of the Platonic Academy, translated the entire Platonic corpus into Latin by the end of the 5th century. So now they have access to all of Plato. Excellent. Except in the writings of Pico della Mirandola and of the Italian philosopher Giordano Bruno, the direct influence of Platonism on Renaissance metaphysics is difficult to trace. The Platonic account of the moral virtues, however, was admirably adopted to the requirements of Renaissance education, serving as a philosophical foundation of the Renaissance ideal of the courtier and gentleman. But Plato also represented the importance of mathematics and the Pythagorean attempt to discover the secrets of the heavens, the earth, and the world of nature in terms of number and exact calculation. This aspect of Platonism influenced Renaissance science as well as philosophy. I mean, they're kind of the same thing at this point. The scientists Nicholas Copernicus, that one should be easy, Johannes Kepler, and Galileo Galilei owe a great deal to the general climate of Pythagorean confidence in the explanatory power of number, which I should say is interesting considering that if you read, well, I think I'll get to this in the next episode, but it's worth touching on here. These interesting influences that people don't expect, you know? I mean, the Pythagoreans were a religious group, and they believe their religion was founded on this incredible insight into the nature of the ordered universe, and that number governs, or is this order. And now the sciences are benefiting from this, even though later on Bacon is going to dismiss Pythagoras as merely superstitious. I find that interesting. We'll get to that again, though. We're going to talk about Bacon in the next episode. But it's worth pointing out, it's worth highlighting here because the Pythagoreans do have influence at this point. Platonism also affected the literary forms in which Renaissance philosophy was written. Although very early medieval Platonists, such as St. Augustine and John Scotus Erigena, occasionally used the dialogue form, later scholastics abandoned it in favor of the formal treatise, of which the great Summae of Alexander of Hales and Aquinas were pristine examples. The Renaissance rediscovery of the Platonic dialogues suggested the literary charm of this conversational method to humanists, scientists, and political philosophers alike. Bruno put forth his central insights in a dialogue concerning the cause, principle, and one. Galileo presented his novel Mechanics in his dialogue concerning the two chief world systems, Ptolemaic and Copernican, and even Machiavelli's The Art of War takes the form of a genteel conversation in a quiet Florentine garden. Renaissance humanism was primarily a moral and a literary rather than a narrowly philosophical movement. It flowered in figures with broadly philosophical interests, such as Desiderius Erasmus, the erudite citizen of the world, and Sir Thomas More, the learned but unfortunate chancellor of Henry VIII, as well as, in the next generation, the great French essayist Michel de Montaigne, But the rediscovery of the Greek and Latin classics, which was the work of humanism, profoundly affected the entire field of Renaissance and early modern philosophy and science through the ancient schools of philosophy to which it once more directed attention. In addition to Platonism, the most notable of these schools were atomism, skepticism, and stoicism. The discovery of Lucretius' De Rerum Natura influenced Galileo, Bruno, and later Pierre Gassendi, a modern Epicurean, through the insights into nature reflected in this work. The recovery of Sextus Empiricus' outlines of Pyrrhonism, reprinted in 1582, produced a skeptical crisis in French philosophy that dominated the period of Montaigne to Descartes, and the Stoicism of Seneca and Epictetus became almost the official ethics of the Renaissance, figuring prominently in the essays of Montaigne. In the letters that Descartes wrote to Princess Elizabeth of Bohemia and to Queen Christina of Sweden, and in the later sections of the Ethics of Benedict de Spinoza. Spinoza's a bit later. Descartes is early modern too, but Stoicism is the moral framework of thinkers at this time. It's no longer cardinal virtues. It's Roman virtues. It's Stoic virtues now.
It's interesting to think about why that might be the case, why Stoicism reemerges, and also reemerges right alongside skepticism. We've talked about this a little bit in the past, but the idea of Stoicism as a discipline of philosophy that saw the fundamental problem as being able to live according to nature, first and foremost your own nature, and then of secondary, although it later became of primary importance, existing within the natural order itself. And I guess in that vein, you could argue that natural science is in fact an offshoot of Stoicism, in that it complements it with the same idea of looking to understand the laws of nature, the invariable things of nature, to which we should act to live in harmony with rather than in opposition against.
Yeah, it is interesting to note that Stoicism alongside skepticism kind of emerges here, though eclectic philosophy has always been a possibility. I mean, Cicero was an eclectic. He was not tied down by any one particular association. I think he does what good philosophers do, which is generally acquaint oneself with the literature and then figure it out for oneself. It's never as clear-cut as the schools put it. And I think that might also contribute to the Renaissance ideal of the gentleman, that one cultivates oneself, and one way of doing that is this afforded opportunity of these classical texts. One can now become acquainted with them. I've read the letters between Descartes and Princess Elizabeth of Bohemia. Princess Elizabeth has this problem. I mean, her family is in all kinds of political turmoil, and Descartes has these solutions that Seneca has written about, how to make problems become less, you can't make the problems materially go away by thinking about it, but you can help yourself go through these problems by resorting to Stoic methods, Stoic practices and whatnot. It's one way of kind of, how do I want to put this? There are new circumstances in this new world, all kinds of exciting enterprises and adventures. One really has the resources to go out and adventure to new lands, or create these new companies, or take on these new national interests. One needs ways of doing this, and classical literature supplies one with a way of comporting oneself in this new world where enormous enterprises are underway.
Mm-hmm. And the Romans were no strangers to political problems.
Mm-hmm.
You might even say that it seems like Stoicism is the the perfect philosophy in terms of dealing, if you're an overworked bureaucrat or a prince or princess whose family is in a precarious position, this is the philosophy for you. It was a philosophy specifically designed to say that the events that happen to you have neutral value, that the events and the effects that happen to us don't dictate who we are. Rather, it's our responses that dictate who we are. Because otherwise, if you believe that the events that happen to you dictate who you are, it doesn't take very long before enough bad things happen that you essentially have to surrender, and that there doesn't seem to be anything else to do. But keeping the Stoic mindset of always choosing your own reactions gives you the sense that your little acts of control can work towards the benefit of those under you, of those who you are in relationship with, in coordination with, in collaboration with. It's one of these philosophies which I find fascinating, because it seems to be like, on one side, everything is about you and being in accordance with nature. But then the outpouring of that is that everything is about working for the overall good of everyone, because that is the most natural thing to do, is to work for the good of other people, or rather to work for the good of people, and that includes you and it includes everyone else.
Yeah, well, I mean, Stoic philosophies would bring those two together and say they're really the same thing. I mean, once you consider your self-interest, you're not, I mean, if you consider your self-interest as a person who exists in the universe, you have to take the universe into account. There's this kind of marriage between what we tend to bring apart quite easily, one's self-interest versus other, you know, allo interests or whatnot. If you can bring those two together in a kind of cosmic or cosmopolitan system like Stoicism, then you can get along quite well. One of the highlights of the Renaissance as well is an exploration of what was previously called natural philosophy, but is now called science. As previously mentioned, it involved a departure from Aristotle, specifically his physics, towards these Pythagorean-influenced understandings of nature in terms of number. Philosophy in the modern world is a self-conscious discipline. It has managed to define itself narrowly, distinguish itself on the one hand from religion, on the other from exact science. But this narrowing of focus came about very late in its history, certainly not before the 18th century. The early philosophers of ancient Greece were theorists of the physical world. Pythagoras and Plato were at once philosophers and mathematicians, and in Aristotle there is no clear distinction between philosophy and natural science. The Renaissance and early modern period continued this breadth of conception characteristic of the Greeks. Galileo and Descartes were at once mathematicians, physicists, and philosophers, and physics retained the name natural philosophy at least until the death of Sir Isaac Newton. Had the thinkers of the Renaissance been painstaking in the matter of definition, which they were not, they might have defined philosophy on the basis of its actual practice as the rational, methodical, and systematic consideration of humankind, civil society, and the natural world. Philosophy's area of interest would thus not have been in doubt, though the issue of what constitutes rational, methodical, and systematic consideration would have been extremely controversial. Because knowledge advances through the discovery and advocacy of new philosophical methods, and because these diverse methods depend for their validity on prevailing philosophical criteria of truth, meaning, and importance, the crucial philosophical quarrels of the 16th and 17th centuries were at bottom quarrels about method. It is this issue, rather than any disagreement over subject matter or areas of interest, that divided the greatest Renaissance philosophers. The great new fact that confronted the Renaissance was the immediacy, the immensity, and the uniformity of the natural world. But what was of primary importance was the new perspective through which this fact was interpreted. To the schoolmen of the Middle Ages, the scholasticists, the universe was hierarchical, organic, and God-ordained. To the philosophers of the Renaissance, it was pluralistic, machine-like, and mathematically ordered. In the Middle Ages, scholars thought in terms of purposes, goals, and divine intentions. In the Renaissance, they thought in terms of forces, mechanical agencies, and physical causes. All of this had become clear by the end of the 15th century. Within the early pages of the notebooks of Leonardo da Vinci, the great Florentine artist and polymath, occur the following three propositions. Proposition 1. Since experience has been the mistress of whoever has written well, I take her as my mistress, and to her on all points make my appeal. Proposition 2. Instrumental or mechanical science is the noblest, and above all others the most useful, seeing that by means of it all animated bodies which have movement perform all their actions. Proposition 3. There is no certainty where one can neither apply any of the mathematical sciences, nor any of those which are based upon the mathematical sciences. Here are enumerated respectively 1, the principle of empiricism, 2, the principle of mechanistic science, and 3, faith in mathematical explanation. It is upon these three doctrines, as upon a rock, that Renaissance and early modern science and philosophy were built. From each of Leonardo's theses descend one of the great streams of Renaissance and early modern philosophy. From the empirical principle, the work of Bacon, from mechanistic, the work of Hobbes, and from mathematical explanation, the work of Descartes. Any adequate philosophical treatment of scientific method recognizes that the explanations offered by science are both empirical and mathematical. In Leonardo's thinking, as in scientific procedure generally, there need be no conflict between these two ideals, yet they do represent two opposite poles, each capable of excluding the other. The peculiar accidents of Renaissance scientific achievement did mistakenly suggest their incompatibility, for the revival of medical studies on the one hand and the blooming of mathematical physics on the other emphasized opposite virtues in scientific methodology. This polarity was represented by the figures of Andreas Vesalius and Galileo. Vesalius, a Flemish physician, astounded all of Europe with the unbelievable precision of his anatomical dissections and drawings. Having invented new tools for this precise purpose, he successively laid bare the vascular, neural, and muscular systems of the human body. This procedure seemed to demonstrate the virtues of the empirical method of experimentation and of inductive generalization on the basis of precise and disciplined observation. Only slightly later, Galileo, following in the tradition already established by Copernicus and Kepler, attempted to do for terrestrial and sidereal movement what Vesalius had managed for the structure of the human body, creating his physical dynamics, however, on the basis of hypotheses derived from mathematics. In Galileo's work, all of the most original scientific impulses of the Renaissance were united. The interest in Hellenistic mathematics, the experimental use of new instruments such as the telescope, and the underlying faith that the search for certainty in science is reasonable because the motions of all physical bodies are comprehensible in mathematical terms. Galileo's work also deals with some of the recurrent themes of 16th and 17th century philosophy. Atomism, which describes the changes of gross physical bodies in terms of the motion of their parts, the reduction of qualitative differences to quantitative differences, and the resultant important distinction between primary and secondary qualities. The former qualities, including shape, extension, and specific gravity, were considered to be part of nature and therefore real. The latter, such as color, odor, taste, and relative position, were taken to be simply the effect of the motions of physical bodies on perceiving minds and therefore ephemeral, subjective, and essentially irrelevant to the nature of physical reality.
It's worth noting that real in this sense means reducible to numbers. Like anything that is real is reducible to number. That's, I guess, one of the things here that comes into the, I guess, as they were saying, like the second thesis of instrumental or mechanical science, that essentially the thing that you have to do without question in mechanical science is to reduce what you're looking at to numbers, to the production and operation of specific quantities relative to their operation. I think today we have a little bit more problems with the science of nature just because we have so much more work on this topic. It's very easy to forget that we make any of these philosophical assumptions or decisions at all. It's very easy to just read a textbook, take the prescribed formula, and perform the calculation without ever considering the assumptions by which those formulas were created or for what their purposes were. It's somewhat similar to the fact that it's become commonplace to use technology without ever thinking about how the technology itself operates. And this is, I think, going to become the fundamental question as we're overlooking kind of the arch of Western philosophy, and that is that what do we need to know in order to operate this machine, which I think a lot of philosophers are automatically offended by what I said, to think of philosophy as a machine. But if we think about all of the achievements and thoughts of our predecessors as something that has rational order and purpose according to nature, how should we operate Western philosophy? How should we move it and use it in order to understand the world and ourselves?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, to bring it back to the Renaissance, I think that the ideal that they set for themselves, one of mathematical precision and one of clarity, which actually is intelligible versus the scholastic conception of approaching truths via this kind of give and take of propositions. I mean, in the Renaissance ideal of mathematics, what you are studying becomes immediately mentally transparent. When you are measuring physical bodies, you don't have to measure them in terms of type or in terms of the ends, which Aristotle would have set for certain kinds of motions. Now you can track them according to anything that you can measure. And what's really exciting is you can find variables. You can find different things to measure. It's not entirely out of the picture to measure things like odor in this kind of mathematical ideal. It's totally open. We just have to find the number for it, wherever that is, whatever that might be. If there is a genius who can come along and measure odors, that's great. The door is always open. We can always move forward because we have this ideal of things that are transparent to our minds, things like number, things like measurement, things like bounds and whatnot. I think that's what makes the Renaissance ideal so... I mean, when we approach Renaissance philosophy, there is this aesthetic element to it, isn't there? We come out of a medieval period. Let's shed the Dark Ages association. Even setting that aside, we come out of what is actually quite a disputatious period, and we enter something that feels very light and comfortable to wear, doesn't it? There is something beautiful about what is aspired to in the Renaissance ideal of making things clear to the mind. I mean, the height of this is going to end up being, or at least in this period, it's going to end up being Descartes. And we'll get into this in our next episode, who tries to find the basis of all of this right down to the bottom of metaphysics. I mean, everything should be clear. There's something so noble about that. And there's something quite beautiful about that. It can be a bit, it can get messy. It can get disputatious in and of itself. I mean, dogmatism is not on the table for the Renaissance thinker, not for the early modern thinker. you have to be able, it has to be clear to the mind. If it doesn't satisfy the mind of its self-evidentness or of its gossamer-like ability to be handled by the mind, you know, numbers are the lightest thing that we can lift, as it were. I think that's where that aesthetic element of the Renaissance comes along, where we're dealing with something that respects our intelligence in a way, something that we as humans are naturally capable of dealing with something that we consider higher, our minds.
It's really interesting to consider that we're talking about like the lightness of describing something with numbers. And I'm sure for a lot of people who struggle with mathematics, they'll be like, well, what on earth are you talking about? Well, you have to understand the alternative is to try to describe something in words that is ill-suited to be described in words. So if we tried to talk about, for instance, the changing distances of the tides, if we describe that in words, we need as many words as we have numbers from, you could say, from one to several thousand. And words don't lend themselves to that type of easy sequential ordering that numbers do. As you are leaving this episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show, be encouraged that is part of your heritage.
Find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca.